Welcome to another screencast from the Northeast Roadshow. For this session, I'm going to take a close look at the underpinnings of LINQ, Language Integrated Query. It's a feature that was introduced with .NET 3.5 just about 2 years ago, but based on people in the audiences that I've surveyed, its adoption rate is less than one might expect. My hope is that by shedding light on how LINQ works under the covers, it will make the technology less mysterious and more approachable. Let's start with the motivation for LINQ, namely the fact that data is not equal to objects. Or, if you're a C# developer, data is not equal to objects. This isn't a new issue. Think back, for instance, to the early days of client-server. Applications written then would target a relational database, say Oracle, DB2, SQL Server, and others, but each of the individual vendors had its own protocols and its own APIs. Even though the data was stored in tables with rows and columns, there wasn't a consistent or vendor-agnostic way to get to that data. That's where technologies like ODBC, OLAdB, and ultimately ADO.NET came in. They provide an abstraction layer for us developers, giving us consistent .NET classes and interfaces, and hiding all of the vendor-specific goo in a provider model that individual vendors have the responsibility to implement. In a lot of ways, LINQ takes that a step further. What ODBC, OLAdB, and ADO.NET did for relational data, LINQ does for all types of data. It provides a set of programmatic interfaces and methods so that you can inspect, sort, and manipulate data regardless of source, in-memory collections, database tables, XML documents, and more. As I mentioned earlier, LINQ was introduced with .NET 3.5 back in November 2007, and its roots are in a project from the early 2000s called C-Omega that was carried out by Microsoft Research. With the goal of addressing the data object impedance mismatch, LINQ continues the provider model philosophy to enable shared data access constructs to be used against data of vastly different origins and shapes. As an extensible architecture, new data sources can be LINQ-enabled as long as a provider is built for that data source. LINQ also ushers in more of a declarative versus an imperative flavor to development, by which I mean you describe what you want to do, not how to do it. Think of SQL, for instance, which one flavor of LINQ resembles. You issue statements like select star from customer where ID equals 123. You don't tell the database how to execute it, you don't pull the data locally and loop through it, you simply indicate what you want and it magically happens. This declarative aspect is also a hallmark of functional programming, so with LINQ you're seeing some functional elements being added to C# and Visual Basic. More are coming with the next version of .NET, namely .NET 4. When LINQ was first introduced, there were several variants included. LINQ to objects applies the constructs and data access mechanisms that we'll soon cover to in-memory objects like collections, lists, and arrays. Also included with .NET 3.5 are LINQ to XML, providing the same functionality for XML documents, and LINQ to SQL. LINQ to SQL creates an object relational model, specifically a set of .NET classes that represent tables in a SQL Server database. Essentially, each table in the database is mapped to a .NET class, and each column in the table becomes a property in that .NET class. A wrapper class, known as a data context, handles object tracking and the communication with the database. So as you make changes to an instance of the .NET class, the data context tracks the modifications and generates the necessary SQL to persist those changes to the underlying database. LINQ to SQL, though, has two significant constraints. It applies only to SQL Server, and the mapping provided is strictly one-to-one. That is, each table in the database maps to a distinct class in the model. In .NET 3.5 SP1, Microsoft introduced the Entity Framework, which takes LINQ to SQL to another level. With the Entity Framework, any database can be targeted, well, anyone with an Entity Framework provider offered for that vendor. Also with the Entity Framework, a conceptual model is introduced. So you can create a class object that maps to multiple tables in the data source. For instance, if your domain's idea of a customer includes an order history, the database probably has several tables to store this data. In your code, though, you probably want to treat this as a single complex object, a customer class with a property that happens to be a collection of order classes. The Entity Framework enables this and other more complex scenarios, and like LINQ to SQL, handles the plumbing, the correlation of object properties to the back-end data, and the communication with the database proper, including transactional semantics. Also with .NET 3.5 SP1, Microsoft introduced ADO.NET Data Services, now known as WCF Data Services, a technology that exposes an entity framework model via the web as a RESTful service. Recently, too, as part of Microsoft's cloud computing platform, SQL Azure, or SQL Server in the cloud, has emerged as another option to store relational data. Both of these technologies also expose a LINQ access mechanism. Beyond what Microsoft provides, there are other LINQ options available via partners and open source projects, like LINQ to Excel, LINQ to Twitter, LINQ to Facebook, and others. All of these access mechanisms share the same programmatic interfaces, so once you know how to get the data from one source, you can apply that same code to all of the other sources, and that's really where the power of LINQ lies. LINQ was introduced in .NET 3.5, but as you might know, .NET 3.5 relies on the same underlying CLR, Common Language Runtime, as .NET 2.0. So in some ways, Link is nothing that you couldn't have done with Visual Studio 2005. It would have been a lot of work, though, and what makes Link viable is a number of syntactic features, syntactic sugar, if you will, added to C# and Visual Basic. Things like lambda expressions, anonymous classes, object initializers, and more. Many presentations on Link will start by explaining what each of these constructs is, but I'm going to take a different approach. As a demo, I'm going to work with a small console application that prints out the list of processes running on my machine, along with their IDs and virtual memory size, grouped by owner and sorted alphabetically. First, we'll examine an imperative-style implementation, and then we'll recreate the same application using Link, along the way introducing the various syntactic features of .NET 3.5 that enable the Link paradigm. So let's fire up Visual Studio and get started. I'll run the application first, and as you can see, we get a list of the processes grouped by owner name and sorted by process name. Let's take a look at the imperative implementation next. If you're familiar with the system.diagnostics namespace, you might know that there's a process class with a static method called getProcesses. This method accesses a lot of information about the process, but unfortunately not all of it. The process's owner name is not available through this mechanism. That's why in my implementation you see a custom class called processInfo. ProcessInfo incorporates the subset of the information needed for just my application, namely the process ID, process name, username, and VM size. I've created a getProcesses method here that calls the system.diagnostics version, but it then augments that information with the owner name. To get the owner name, I've created another helper method that uses Windows Management Infrastructure to get the owner name based on the process ID. So now within my main program, I can call the static getProcesses method of my custom process info class to get all the information I'm looking for. Next, though, I have to sort this information. And to sort, I need to implement iComparer on my custom class. Otherwise, there's no way for the sort procedure to know whether one process is larger than another process. The implementation for that is straightforward, though, and it amounts to checking the process owner names first, and then checking the process names themselves if the owner names are the same. With the implementation of the custom class and iComparer, I now just need to print out the list of processes, formatting it appropriately as the header or process owner changes. And that's our starting point. Hopefully the concepts here are generic enough for you to mentally apply to similar constructs in your own domain, but interesting enough to be a meaningful example on how to implement this same functionality with Link. We'll start with a blank slate and work our way up from there. First, I'll comment out the imperative implementation so it doesn't get in our way. And to speed things up, I've already included the output loops, which I'll just uncomment when needed. By the way, all of the code I'm working with here is available at the code gallery, code.msdn.com/northeast. Now let's start by getting a list of the processes. We have to start somewhere, so I'll use the built-in capabilities of the system.diagnostics process class. We'll run the application, and sure enough, we get what is expected, a list of processes. Of course, it's not sorted yet, though. So what's next? Well, I do need to pull in the owner names, and you'll recall I had to do that via another method that interfaced with WMI. I want to defer that for a moment, though, and start a bit more simply, with a sort of the process names. In my pre-link example, you'll recall that we called the sort method on our collection, which necessitated creating an iComparer implementation as well. Here we have an array, so I could take the same route, call array.sort, and here I'd need another custom comparer, but that's no fun, and in fact it has a bad code smell. Link is supposed to make our jobs easier and coding more concise, so this just doesn't seem right. Let's see if there's another way. Take a look at the IntelliSense that gets triggered on my plist reference. Remember, this is just an array, but I'm seeing a lot of methods that I know aren't part of the array class, and those methods have a blue arrow in the glyph. That designates them as extension methods, the first piece of syntactic sugar we're going to encounter. The extension methods you see here are shown because they are defined for the IEnumerable interface, and most of the collection types, including array, implement IEnumerable, which, by the way, is the linchpin of Link. One of the extension methods in this list is orderBy, and that looks promising for our needs, but let's take a look at a simpler one, say take, which skims the first n items off the list. So let's return just the first 5 processes and print those out. In the old days, we just put in a loop counter and break when the counter hit our limit, but we're Link people now, so that won't do. Well, that doesn't compile. It looks like take is returning an IEnumerable, and it doesn't like assigning that to my array. Of course, I might be tempted to cast it back to an array of processes, but whenever I do a cast, I'm always suspicious if that's the right way. Or I could assign it to a variable of type system.collection.ienumerable, as the error suggests, and that will work, but it's making my coding experience more cumbersome versus less. In fact, it always annoys me when the compiler tells you what the error is, but it can't self-correct itself. Since the compiler obviously knows the types here, let it figure out. Instead of assigning a type to the reference explicitly, defer to the compiler by using the var keyword. The var keyword does not mean variant, as you might suspect if you have a VB background. We've seen already that there's a lot of strong typing here. Rather, var is shorthand for, "Developer, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it for you." What you're seeing here is type inference, another of the link enablers. The compiler is using its know-how to help you out. I can do something like this, and the compiler infers that I is an integer by its context. And to drive home the point that we're still strongly typed, I can try, but fail, to assign a string to that same variable. I'm going to clean this up a little bit here. We really don't need that extra plist2 variable. We can just compose the query since each call generates an IEnumerable for the next method to pick up. Now when I run, I get the first 5 elements in the array of processes. Take, again, is an extension method, and we've seen it in action, but let's dissect it a little bit more. Actually, let's write our own. We'll call it take2, and I'll call it here. I've already implemented it below, so we'll just uncomment the implementation. Note that an extension method is a static method, generally placed in a static utility class. What makes it an extension method is that the type it extends is the first parameter of the method, and is preceded with the keyword this. The compiler uses that syntax to recognize that the method can be called like an instance method on the type specified in that parameter. Note the output. We're getting a line from the main method interspersed with a debug line written in take2. That should tell you that take2 isn't really being invoked on this line, but rather as the for each is iterating over the enumerable collection. Take2 is actually getting invoked separately for each iteration versus once, something known as deferred execution. A closer look at the extension method shows the use of the yieldReturn construct. This will return a single value from the method, but retain the call stack, so the next time take2 is executed, it picks up from where it left off. YieldBreak indicates that we're really truly done with the method. Under the covers, the forEach code is also being wrapped by a try-finally block to implement the iDisposable pattern. With this construct, you can actually create infinite sequences, since the entire collection doesn't have to be stored in memory at one time. For a Fibonacci sequence, for instance, you need only the previous 2 numbers to generate the next. Unfortunately, yield is a keyword in C# 3.0, but not in Visual Basic 9. That changes, though, with .NET 4, when Visual Basic also gets the yield keyword. So that's an extension method. We've written our own, but IEnumerable has a bunch already, and they really are what carry out the link capabilities of sorting, filtering, and so on. So let's get back to our task. I diverged into a tour of extension methods, since I'd noticed that orderBy was an extension method as well. OrderBy, though, takes something a bit more complex than the integer we saw with take. Its argument is a func process tkey, whatever that is. Well, we're going to make one and pass it on in. The name tkey, combined with the fact that this is an OrderBy operation, should clue you into the fact that it wants the type of the value in which you plan to sort. In our case, we'll sort on the process name, which is a string. So I've got a foo, and now I can pass that to OrderBy, but I'm still not sure what this func thing is. F12 it, and I can see it's a generic delegate for a method taking a type t, here a process, and returning a t result, here a string, which is a sort key for the given process. So let's build a method to do just that. Well, that works, but my "I'm writing too much code" alarm was just triggered. We should be able to shorten this a bit with an anonymous delegate, a construct introduced with C# 2.0. With the anonymous delegate invocation, I no longer need my external function declaration. Okay, that works too, but you know what? We can do even better. The compiler knows what it wants here, a delegate, what the argument is, a process, and what the return type should be, a string. So we're still writing too much redundant code. Let me rewrite this delegate. What I've created here is a lambda expression, another of the link enablers, essentially used here as an anonymous delegate. The equals greater than symbol is known as the goes to operator, and what appears on the left are essentially the parameters. Here, p represents a given process instance. On the right side of the operator is the code to be executed. Here is just a single expression, and a return is assumed. Note, since lambdas are just delegates, they have benefits elsewhere as well. Event handlers, for instance, are a great place to use lambdas, since they shorten the amount of code you have to write, especially for simple one- or two-line methods. Let's run this sample, and you'll notice that another thing has happened here. Because I've added an order by, I've short-circuited the deferred execution. The output lines are no longer interspersed because the take2 method has been run for all of the elements before the first line of output in the for each loop. This makes sense since you can't order a sequence until you know what all the elements are. Likewise, aggregate functions like sum, count, and average will force all of the elements of the IEnumerable to be materialized right away. With that point made, let's get rid of the take2 call and deal with all of the processes returned from here on out. Now we've got a simple order by, but remember we still don't have the information for the process owner rolled in yet. So what I need to do is tack on another piece of information to the process, namely the string that I can get from the utility method that uses WMI to get the owner name. No longer am I just returning the built-in list of process information. I'm actually shaping the data. In SQL, for instance, the analog would be moving from a select star from processes statement to select ID, username, and so on from processes. And in link, there indeed just happens to be a select extension method. It's looking for another delegate, or lambda expression, that takes in a process and returns a new class containing the data we need. Here, four properties. What I've created here is a projection. It retains a few fields of my initial process info and adds another piece in from the getProcessOwner method call. That information is all assembled into a new class, an anonymous class. It has no external name, but the .NET CLR is keeping track of it. Since it's an anonymous class, there wasn't any way to have a pre-written constructor to initialize the members of the class. So you can see here that they're initialized in line, using another of the link enabling features, object initializers. I've renamed a few of the fields, but retained the name for the process name field. Initializing class instances like this isn't limited to anonymous classes. If you're initializing a class that doesn't have a constructor, for instance, to handle perhaps that one extra field you always seem to need to set, you can use this technique as well to keep your code crisp and more maintainable. Since I've changed the shape of my data here, the for each is exhibiting a problem. The collection that results from this call is no longer a process list, but a list of some unknown anonymous class. I could find out the name that the compiler assigned to it, something like anonymous type #1, but I'm not guaranteed it's always that same type when compiled, so the var keyword and implicit typing come to our rescue again. Now that I've got all the data together, I can readjust the sort. We've now got our list sorted just the way we want, and we could print it out just as we did the original list before, with a little bit of logic to track the current header for each group. But link provides us a group by extension method as well, the result of which is a collection of objects with a field representing the grouping criteria, and an additional field that's a collection of all the items associated with that group, a master detail type relationship. Adding the group by is pretty simple. But since we've reshaped the data, we need to fix up our for each loop again, which now expects a collection that in turn contains collections. So I'll paste in a revised for each loop, execute, and we're back to the results of the imperative implementation we started out with. Our implementation here, though, is literally one line of code. Okay, it's a longish line of code, but there was no need to create an explicit class like processInfo or an iComparer implementation for the sort. And as requirements change, it will be quite a bit easier to modify this declarative code to add additional fields, sort criteria, etc. Up to this point, we've been working with link by interacting with extension methods directly. But link also provides a number of keywords that you can use as well to provide that more SQL-like syntax that many link presentations lead with. Those keywords are just more syntactic sugar as they eventually get compiled down to the same extension methods we've been dealing with. Here's a translation of what we just did into code using keyword syntax. It definitely connotes a more functional approach, but it's really up to you as to how you code it. You can't do everything using the standard query operators. But since it's all the same under the covers, you're just pushing around a bunch of IEnumerables, you can mix and match. Now let's switch gears a tad bit. What we've been looking at so far are constructs applied specifically to link to objects, that is, in-memory collections. There are other variants of link, though, that apply to data stored elsewhere, out of process, like link to SQL and link to entities. Here, for instance, is the same query we've been looking at, but using link to SQL against a SQL Server 2008 database with a simple table called processes. The link statement is identical to what we've been looking at all along, but the source of the data is no longer an in-memory collection, but rather a table class exposed by the link to SQL data model, specifically on the link to SQL data context. One major difference is that the return value of the query is now iQueryable and not IEnumerable. With all that talk of IEnumerable before, where does iQueryable come in? Well, first off, iQueryable extends IEnumerable, so everything we've talked about so far applies here as well. But there's something else that iQueryable adds. Let's put a breakpoint on the for each as we execute. Look at the value of the query. It's showing as a SQL statement because the link provider, link to SQL, has translated the link syntax to SQL. This is where iQueryable comes in. Note that I can get a view into something known as an expression tree using a visualizer in the debugger. What's happening is that the iQueryable is causing an expression syntax tree to be generated based on the link query you've coded. It's not executing anything directly, but treating your link statement as essentially data. It's up to individual providers, like link to SQL, to translate this expression tree into something that the back-end data source will understand. For link to SQL, it's T-SQL. But for link to WCF data services, for instance, it would actually be a RESTful HTTP URL. Despite the vast differences in what's going on under the covers, the developer's programmatic experience remains nearly identical across the board. And again, that's the beauty of Link. Learn once, use everywhere. And that concludes our tour of the core features or enablers of Link. There is, of course, a lot of functionality that we didn't cover, like what all of those other extension methods do. But those features all build on the concepts we've covered in this session, so they are essentially just icing on the cake. Going back to the slides, let me leave you with a few additional references on Link. First, LinkPad is a great notepad-type tool to play around with Link and get a feel for what all of those other keywords and extension methods do. PLink stands for Parallel Link and adds additional features to link to objects to easily take advantage of multiple CPU environments. It will be a native part of the .NET 4 framework, but you can also use it in .NET 3.5 via the parallel extensions to the .NET framework. There's a separate developer area for Link on MSDN, and of course you can reference all of the extension method and interface documentation as well. A really helpful resource, available to both C# and VB.NET developers, is the 101 Link Examples on MSDN. Here you can find short, specific examples on how to do well-defined tasks with Link, like performing joins, using aggregate operators, implementing paging, and more. It's definitely something to add to your IE favorites as you become more and more linked in. That brings us to the end of this rather dense session. If you made it this far, I applaud your tenacity and thank you for your attention. I do hope it gave you more insight into the mechanics of Link, insight which, for me at least, greatly reduced the mystery of how Link works. I wish you a great rest of your day.